You can see the progression here. Jesus makes it clear that he is not doing away with the law, and then he goes through to elaborate on that and to explain. He actually makes the law more binding, not less binding, not doing away with it, but making it more binding by showing the true spiritual intent. So it's not just a matter of murdering somebody. It's a matter of how you feel about somebody, whether you resent or hate that person. It's not just a matter of the physical act of adultery, but what is going on in your mind and your heart there that could lead to that. So he actually makes the law more binding, harder to follow, not easier. I'm not doing away with that. Continuing, picking up now, we get into laws regarding divorce, which was allowed under certain circumstances. But here Jesus goes in and explains, again, the spiritual intent of the law. Matthew 5 and verse 31. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery when she remarries there. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. This sounds somewhat odd to us, but we need to understand some of the background and what's going on in people's mind and thinking at that period. Among the Jewish rabbis of that day, and you've read how Paul was schooled at a famous rabbinical school, there were different schools of thought and different rabbis. And of course, Jesus is a rabbi, as we've talked as well. But there were two major schools of thought regarding divorce there. And of course, whoever followed a particular rabbi, you were bound by that rabbi's interpretation of the law. So there are two very different ideas about divorce at that time. Those who followed the Rabbi Hillel, who is one of the famous rabbis in the decades before leading up to this time, Hillel, he said it was permissible for a husband to divorce his wife for just about any reason at all. If she burned the bread, he could divorce her. If she was a bad cook, he could divorce her. If she could not bear children, he could divorce her. If she wasn't a good housekeeper, he could divorce her. So he taught that basically you can divorce your wife for any reason, pretty much any reason there. So that was one major viewpoint in culture of that day. But there was another school of thought following the Rabbi Shammai, who is another one. You don't have to remember these names here. But Shammai, who said divorce was permissible only for a major offense or sin like sexual immorality, committing adultery with somebody else. So what we see here is that Jesus actually follows a stricter interpretation of the law, which of course is what God intended in the first place. So Jesus here strongly teaches that God views marriage as a unit that cannot be dissolved for any and every reason, and that marriages should not be ended by divorce except for sexual immorality or marital unfaithfulness. And this is what we teach in the United Church of God today, the same view that Jesus expresses here. Yeah, again, you could get into all kinds of what-if scenarios and all that, which we don't have time to get into, but this is, you know, quite clear what Jesus teaches here. Continuing on, now we get into laws, for lack of a better word, regarding oaths, taking oaths. Matthew 5 and verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, nor shall you swear... Okay, all right, sorry, I left out part of the scripture here. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Why does he even bring that up? This isn't something we have to deal with much in modern society. other than swearing in a court of law, which we don't do, that does come up that you have to testify in a trial or something, there is a legal exemption, so you don't have to lay your hand on the Bible and say, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But Pharisees at that time had all kinds of conditions for their oaths, as we see here. They would swear by the temple or the gold that is in the temple. But Jesus, his point here is that oaths should not even be necessary. That's why he says, don't swear at all, that you should be a person of your word. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. You don't have to swear that this is what you are going to do. That your word should be good enough, and we should be people of our word. If we commit to doing something, that's what we should do. So, again, not a whole lot of detail to go into here. He makes it pretty clear. But the background there is because they did come up with all kinds of elaborate oaths, as is mentioned here. Not something that's necessarily relevant today, other than we should be people of our word. Next, he moves on to the command about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. So he covers several different things here, so let's break this down a little bit. First of all, the principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that sounds very brutal to us. And you can, again, go back. It would be quite a detailed study to get into all of the ramifications of that. But a lot of people misunderstand that. It's not that that was actually required that it be done this way, because mercy could be extended. But the point is actually different than the way most people read that, and that is that the retaliation, if you got in a fist fight with somebody and you knocked out one of their teeth, they cannot come back and knock out three of your teeth in return. It was actually to limit the amount of recompense, you might say, for lack of a better word. If somebody poked you in the eye and caused you to lose your vision in that eye, you could not go back and destroy both of their eyes. So it was actually a limiting factor. That's the purpose of the law, not to exact vengeance on the other person. So the punishment, to put it briefly, the punishment has to be equivalent to the original damage or the original offense and not go beyond that. And Jesus gives a new perspective on this, which is the whole point. And he says that while the rights of the innocent are protected by law, that the righteous, the person who is aggrieved, doesn't necessarily have to claim those rights and to exact revenge or vengeance. There, as we talked about in discussing the Beatitudes, a righteous man is going to be, or a righteous woman is going to be characterized by humility, by selflessness, by an attitude of giving and forgiving and merciful, and showing mercy and so on. And consequently, you might choose to go the extra mile to maintain peace rather than exacting vengeance. Here. So what Jesus is describing in this scenario, that we are wronged by being struck on the cheek or sued for clothing, we wouldn't have to strike back. We wouldn't have to demand repayment or refuse to comply. Instead, we can be, again, you have to look at this in the context of the Beatitudes that he gave there. We can be merciful. We can be peacemakers and not demand our full rights according to the law. So instead of retaliating, we can do the opposite and have faith and trust in God that eventually he's going to take care of it. We don't have to seek revenge. We don't have to seek recompense if we have been wronged. And of course, what did Jesus Christ do when he is suffering the ultimate wrong? We read about this in 1 Peter 2, verse 21. where Peter says, "For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, and repeatedly as he is arrested, as he is tried, as he is kept in the Roman guardhouse, you might say, they mock him, they spit on him, they pummel him. But when he is reviled, as Peter says here, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to God, who judges righteously." And that's the whole point of what is being said here. God can take care of it in his own time. We don't have to do that. And Jesus also here refers to a very common practice of that time. About verse 41, "He who compels you to go 1 mile, go with him two." Well, what in the world is that talking about? This was a very common practice of the time that a Roman soldier, and this is part of the Roman Empire, according to Roman law, a soldier could stop somebody along the road and compel the person to take his pack with him for a mile. Now, a Roman soldier's pack weighed probably in the neighborhood of 50 to 70 pounds. It would have things like his blanket. It would have several days of rations. It would have some water in it. It would have tools and weapons. So you might think about the biggest backpack you can imagine. And a Roman soldier could legally demand any pedestrian he met along a road to take his pack for a mile. I assume you've all seen mile posts along the highways, the interstates and so on. There's very little we do today that we didn't get from the Romans. The Romans actually had mile posts along their roads, their major roads, and they find them all over the Roman world. And so that's an idea we picked up strictly from the Romans. And they find these in Israel too. You can see them in a number of the museums in Israel. And, you know, this is mile 20 from Jerusalem or mile 10 from Caesarea, or something like that. So you knew what a mile distance was. It's not to say they had those on every road at every mile. But what Jesus says here is that to go above and beyond. So let's say you're a Jewish civilian, you're a farmer, and you happen to encounter a Roman soldier on the road, and he compels you to go with him a mile carrying his pack, which is going to irritate you because you're, you know, walking 12, 15 minutes to walk the mile, and then you gotta take that much time to walk back to where you were originally, so it's definitely an inconvenience. But Jesus says, his whole point here is be a peacemaker. Be a peacemaker. If a Roman soldier tells you to carry his pack for a mile, don't just stop there and lay it down and go back. Carry it too. And think about how a Roman soldier is gonna react in that day, because believe me, there's a lot of hostility between the Romans and the Jews. The Jews want what? They want to kick out the Romans and get them out of there so they can have their own kingdom. But imagine following Jesus' advice here, what impression that would have made on a Roman soldier. If a Jewish farmer carries his pack not the 1 mile that is required, but takes it another mile, a Roman soldier is going to think, hey, you know, maybe these Jews aren't so bad and obnoxious after all. So that would make a huge impression on somebody, and that is Jesus' point. Go above and beyond in being a peacemaker and setting the right example and having an attitude of giving and serving and so on. So if you are wrong, the whole point here is if you are wrong, don't attack, don't strike back, don't try to seek revenge. Try to work out some kind of amicable relationship. Does this mean that you can never defend yourself or defend your right? No, that's not what he is saying. We ought to be able to defend ourselves, but not to the point of taking somebody's life there. So if you're mugged on a street, do you just let the mugger beat you up? No, you don't do that. What Jesus is talking about here is if somebody hits you, you can defend yourself, but keep yourself from your family from getting hurt. You know, run away, yell, scream for help. Offer a quick prayer about it. Do whatever you can. But you do have a right to defend yourself. I'd like to ask for a volunteer now to come up here and hit me in the face. Oh, Andrew, I was hoping it wouldn't be you or Stephen. You guys are too big. But okay, come on. Actually, we'll turn it around. I'll hit you in the face. So come on. Come on up here.
Wait, legit or no?
No. Come on up. Come on. Yeah. Now notice what this says here. So whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. So let's get up here in front of the audience. Show and tell time. Okay. All right. You're right-handed, right?
Yes.
Okay. In that time, everybody would have been right-handed because you see reference to this in the Bible, that somebody who was left-handed was an oddball. It was weird. If any of you are left-handed, don't take that as an insult. I married a lefty, so don't tell her this. But so I have nothing against left-handers. Just everybody was right-handed then. So you need to understand that. Okay. Which is my right cheek?
Your right cheek. This
right here. Okay. So slow motion. Swing like you're going to slap me on this cheek.
Oh, on that cheek.
No, you're right. Well, you're right-handed.
So it would be backhanded.
Exactly. Good point. Because if he's going to strike me on my right cheek, he can't do it as we would normally view that. It's talking about backhanding somebody. It's not talking about a fist fight or something like that. It's talking about insulting somebody by backhanding them like that. It's very different from the way this has traditionally been interpreted. Okay, you can sit down now. Thanks, Andrew. So yeah, that's why every word in the Gospels is important there, because Jesus specifically says, slaps you not on your cheek. We tend to read over that it's the right cheek. The only way you can hit somebody with a right cheek if you're right-handed is a backhand. It's talking about an insult, degrading you. So Jesus's point, if somebody is just going to insult you and backhand you across one cheek, don't retaliate. Don't fight back. Just, if he's going to do that, just turn the other cheek. Take it. His point is it's better to take it than to start a fist fight and a brawl there and possibly injure or hurt the other person. So this is not a blanket condemnation of self-defense as many people have interpreted this over the years. It's not talking about that. You do have a right to defend yourself. So what it is talking about is this insulting situation, like the same scenario essentially as going the extra mile. Go out of your way to be a peacemaker is the point here. Again, it's when we read it in that context, everything he says here is perfectly consistent. So we do have a right to defend ourselves. So that is not what Jesus Christ is talking about here. The principle is don't avenge yourself. Don't do anything to defend yourself. Don't take vengeance. Don't avenge yourself. So don't strike back. So clear to everybody? You really need to see it and demonstrate it like that. So thanks, Andrew. Yes, Julie. Yeah.
I feel like I'm getting two different... I feel like I'm hearing get two different sides, and I don't know which one is right. Because I feel like part of the time you're saying that's okay to attack others if you're attacked. But then at the same time, I feel like you're saying that we shouldn't...
Yeah. Okay. Let me try to clarify it a little bit there. If somebody, let's just use a scenario of mugging. That's probably the most common crime, or somebody's breaking into your house. Let's use this because there is a biblical precedent for this. There's an exact law. I don't know where it is off the top of my head, but under the old covenant law, and who's the one who gave the law? The one who became Jesus Christ. If somebody were breaking into your house, it were nighttime, you are allowed under that law to kill that person if it's at night. Because at night, you do not know what the person's intent is. You don't know whether they are there to steal your stuff, to kidnap your child and sell that child into slavery, for which the death penalty was mandated for that, for kidnapping somebody to sell into slavery. You don't know their intents, but you are allowed under that law to kill somebody if they broke into your house at night. In the daytime, you could not kill that person, because in the daytime, you can discern what is going on. You can yell or scream for help and get other people. So a different different scenario for different circumstances. What happens on the night that Jesus Christ is taken captive there in Gethsemane? What does Peter do? Peter pulls out his what? Sword, and tries to cut off the head of the high priest's servant. Peter's packing heat, which seems to be common at that time because of robbers and things like that. If Jesus Christ taught we should never defend ourselves, why, what's Peter doing with a sword? You read the other accounts, they actually have two swords among them. So they're carrying something for self-defense. So it is definitely not, God is definitely not against capital punishment because it's mandated a number of times. He's definitely not against self-defense, as we see from examples like that. That Peter, one of the disciples, well, two of the disciples, we don't know who the other one was, but they're carrying swords from there for self-defense. So clearly, you just read a few things like that, and it's clear that we are allowed to defend ourselves and our property and our homes and that sort of thing. But at the same time, yeah, you kill somebody and there can be devastating consequences. You can, if you, yeah, get in a brawl and injure somebody and the person dies or something, you can be sued and lose everything you have, even though the other person started it. With our laws today, you can never tell what kind of judgment is going to be rendered. So just avoid that if you can, but there will or may become circumstances where you can't avoid it. So Jesus's point is, yeah, be a peacemaker. Do de-escalate conflicts. Don't get into an arguing match with somebody, which proceeds to a shouting match, which proceeds to fist fight and this kind of thing. Be a peacemaker is the whole point. And that's why he says, if somebody backhands you as an insult, take it rather than getting involved in a fight with somebody, because you never know what's going to happen if things continue to escalate. So it's just the reality. Hope that explains it. Explains some. Yes, Charlie. Yeah.
I'm personally a little confused because I've heard people in the church, even like during a Bible study, say that like even if somebody like comes into your house at night and like, for example, attacks your wife, you can't, yeah. You have to do everything in your power not to hurt that person and just trust that God will do something in that case. Now, me personally, I'm okay with self-defense.
Right.
I mean, if someone's attacking my wife, to me, it seemed a little cowardice just to stand there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
So what's the official teaching on that? Because you seem to be more on what I believe.
The official teaching has varied off and on over the years. I personally have known a good friend of my brother who was in the church years ago was a police officer who was a church member down in Birmingham, Alabama, and carried a gun. I worked years ago in Pasadena, and my supervisor was a reserve deputy sheriff. So, and this was back in the this is going back to the 70s. So. When I lived in Big Sandy, there was a, never mind, I'm thinking of somebody else. So the church has actually kind of gone back and forth on that over the years. My position is spelled out right here and in the example that I cited. I think we tend to read the scriptures and read into it what we want to read into it and ignore some of the obvious things, like the one I mentioned that Jesus is carrying a sword and another disciple is carrying the sword on the last night Jesus is with them. It's very clear they had no problem with self-defense. And a sword at that time was typically about yay long, roughly an 18-inch blade. We're not talking about, a huge thing. It's 5 or 6 feet long, but it would be something that you could tuck into your belt or rope and carry it. So now we do clearly teach against joining the military. That's clearly spelled out in our fundamental beliefs. They're about military service. There are all kinds of problems with that. I've known a few kids who've grown up in the church and joined the military for good and altruistic reasons. Don't get me wrong about that. I'm glad those people are there. But that brings a whole host of issues. It is an issue that, in my opinion, we need to study some more and refine some and be more clear on what we teach. But yes, Stephen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we don't really have an official position, is kind of what you're saying.
Yeah.
On that. So our fundamental belief covers military service and war and bearing arms in that context of military service and war. But as far as I can tell from kind of our written material and what we have out there, we don't have a strong, you know, we don't draw a clear line and kind of leave that to people to decide for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, as we've seen from the recent school shootings and the debate that's going on about that, how many of you are familiar with the shooting in a Church of God that happened in Milwaukee? This is about 10 years ago. The church pastor who was shot and killed in Sabbath services, a personal friend of mine. I'd gone to college for 4 years with him. His roommate was my wife's roommate in college, so that is something that hit us pretty hard. It's just, unfortunately, a reality of life. We had a brief, we had council meetings last week down in East Texas, and this, we actually had a brief, about a 15-20 minute presentation by Lee Stolle, who used to be the head of security at the Big Sandy campus there. And Lee was a former policeman. And I didn't ask him whether he packs heat or anything. I don't know. I can tell you when I first came into the church in 1970 in Alabama, in any church parking lot like you would have on a Sabbath, there'd probably be at least 10 of those vehicles out there would have guns under the seat of the cars just because everybody did it back then. And it's still that way probably in rural portions of the country and the state. So I don't have any issue with that. I grew up where a gun was a tool. People hunted all the time with it. I hunt. I have 3 guns of my own, 2 pistols and a rifle. So, yeah, you guys are living in a very different culture from that. And there are a lot of factors in it. So as our fundamental belief states right now, yeah, it's a matter of military service. It's not restricting people from serving in law enforcement or something like that. Doesn't mean it's a good idea to serve in law enforcement. And our recommendation over the years has been, when people come into the church who are in law enforcement, if you can get out, then it's the same thing we've taught about military service. If somebody comes into the church being in the armed forces, to try to get out as soon as you can. Because when you're in the military, you surrender all of your rights. You don't get to choose to keep the Sabbath if you want to. You don't get to choose what you eat if everything on the menu is unclean. You surrender all your rights as a Christian when you serve in the military. You serve another God, and that God is your commanding officer. So that's another whole aspect of serving in the military we haven't really addressed fully there. So hope that helps. Some there's a lot of shades and nuances and circumstances to consider there. We have in the church in times past had. Well, when I graduated from high school, the Vietnam War ended just a few years later, but we had to register. Well, actually, technically, people still have to register for the draft, even though there isn't one. But there was very much a draft when I graduated from high school. And my older brother, who's 5 years older than me, he had to work as a... he had a very high draft number, so he had to work as in a nonprofit service capacity as basically a janitor at a hospital for the equivalent that he would have spent time in the military there. So that was very common a couple of decades ago. Now it's not because it's an all-volunteer army, but many countries around the world, I know this has been an issue, James, you may have heard this, in Rhodesia and South Africa, draft at that time, years ago, was compulsory. Everybody served in the military. Same thing with Israel, where the Brits have been. Men, women, they all serve in the military with very, very rare exceptions there. So that's a reality some of our members face around in other parts of the globe. So, okay, yes, Paula. Yeah.
that it says to turn the other cheek and to let people insult us. But at the same time, when a lot of people and the Pharisees were disrespecting Jesus, he defended himself. So can we understand this as to pick our battles and if it's worth it to defend our point of view or to sustain our arguments? We should, but if not, we just turn the other cheek to people.
Yes. His whole point here is you don't have to stand up and assert your rights. Better to be a peacemaker than to cause friction with other people. Of course, we're all talking about within the boundaries of God's law, and understand if somebody orders you to work on the Sabbath, don't do that. You have legal protections that you can and should assert your rights in that. But if it's a matter of interpersonal relationships here, the whole context of what he's talking about here is, better to be a peacemaker than create conflict, possible consequences that you cannot predict in circumstances like that. Yes, Emily?
So essentially what this is saying is, because if we're discussing here specifically more on the idea of somebody insulting you, there is absolutely nothing wrong with defending like the thing they're insulting you about. There is something wrong with insulting them back. That's what we're going for.
Yeah,
you're allowed to say like, well, no, actually, it's this, or like, I believe this, whatever. You're allowed to do that. It's just about not
retaliating.
Yeah,
one of my favorite proverbs is a soft answer turns away wrath. And that's perfectly consistent. That's essentially what Jesus is talking about here. A soft answer turns away wrath. If they attack you, just, well, have you thought about it this way? or I can tell that this is not a good time to have this discussion, so we can talk about it sometime later. Something like that. De-escalate the situation and the tension, and be a peacemaker. So, that's the whole point. Because if it escalates, you never know where it's going to go. But it's probably not going to be pretty. You can pretty much guarantee that. It's interesting, assault, technically, under U.S. law, assault can be a matter of word. That's why there's two separate charges you'll read about, assault and battery. Battery is when you actually start striking blows, battering somebody. Assault can be just words and threats and this kind of thing. So be aware of that. Even the law shows that assault can be what you do with your words. So something to keep in mind. Okay, all right. Where were we? Okay, all right. Next point. Any other questions about that? Okay. Clear as mud, huh? Okay. All right, verse 43, Matthew 5, verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. And again, consider the context. This leads right on from what we were just talking about here. Love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. So I should mention here, too, that most people assume that Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament scriptures in each of these passages. And some he is, like you've heard it said, you shall not murder, or you shall not commit adultery. Here he says, you shall love your neighbor, which is quoted from Deuteronomy, but hate your enemy. God nowhere says, hate your enemy. That is something the Pharisees had added as their interpretation of it. Nowhere says that. Jesus Christ makes that clear. I say to you, love your enemies, don't hate them. So this is the Pharisees spinning this and adding to it and saying, hate your enemy. That's not what God says. It tells us to love our neighbor, but not to hate our enemies. So again, the Pharisees taught that a person should love those who are near and dear to him, friends, family, and so on, but to hate Israel's enemies. And of course, it gets into this mindset of wanting to throw out the Romans and so on. They hated, they detested the Romans. there. But Jesus' point here is we should show God's love toward everybody, even if they are hostile to us, even if they are potentially enemies there. We should show God's love toward them. Where else are they going to see it, if not from us? Continuing, verse 46, "For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so?" So Jesus then goes on to explain that God loves everyone. He sends rain on the just and the unjust, on the righteous and the unrighteous. So his love extends to everyone. And in the same way, our love should be extended to everyone. It's not always easy. It's not comfortable. It gets us out of our comfort zone. But if his point here is, he says, if we love only those who love us, then that's nothing more than what the pagans and the tax collectors did. So that's his point there. And then he says, "Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect." That's the ultimate example that we look to. God's righteousness and God's perfection. That is the standard we are aiming for. If we are to be righteous, we have to be as God is, which is perfect. That is spiritually mature, holy people. So all the things that Jesus has talked about here, murder, hating people in our hearts, lust, lusting in our minds, committing adultery, hate, deception, retaliation, all of these ugly things that he says here, do not characterize, they're not descriptive of the kind of character we should have. We have a different standard. Our standard is God's perfection in our lives. That is our goal. That is what we are aiming for. Gets back to, again, the point I made a number of times. What is the goal of a disciple? The goal of a disciple is to be just like his master in every way. And that's the point that he's making here. Our goal is to be like our master, our rabbi, our teacher, Jesus Christ. That standard of righteousness. Okay, so now we come to chapter 6. So Jesus has gone through and explained that he's not doing away with the law, and he's given specific examples that that make the law even harder to keep. By we have to keep it in our minds, not just in our physical actions. So now he again contrasts. He shifts gears a little bit, goes into some of the common religious practices of the Pharisees, where they have corrupted the law and drifted away from God's intent. So he gives several different specific examples here, how they had turned giving alms, giving offerings, or giving money to the poor, and fasting and prayer in public, how they turned it into a public show and spectacle, rather than a private act of worship, which is God intends it to be. And in so doing, they miss the whole point of what our attitude should be. Jesus says in verse 5, I'm just summarizing the first few verses here. As Jesus says in verse 5, they wanted to be seen by other people, so they do these things in public. And Jesus says, well, that's their reward. They wanted to be seen by people. They were seen by people. And that's all the reward they're going to get, because their heart was not right. So again, this is fairly self-explanatory, so won't go into and comment on it more than that. Let's see. Now we get to... Okay, let's pick it up now with the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 and verse 9. Yeah, leading up to this, Jesus has talked about the wrong approach to prayer, which is like the Pharisees did, praying in public, making a public spectacle of it. So now he goes into the kind of attitude that we should have in prayer, beginning in verse 9. "In this manner, therefore, pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. And of course, most of us probably have this memorized, which we should. And a lot of people think that's it. You just pray this you know, 30-second prayer and you're good to go. But that's not what his point is. This is actually talking more or less an outline for prayer. He's giving us an outline with certain key elements that should be in our minds as we pray. And the first of these, as we read here, is to honor God. Hallow means to make holy or to set apart as holy. So we honor God the Father by acknowledging His holiness and His greatness and His love toward us. So first key point, start off by framing your prayer, understanding who it is you're praying to. You're praying to the greatest being in the universe, in existence here, God the Father. So he starts off, honor God the Father. Then we pray for God's kingdom to come. Your kingdom come here. So this is a theme. Yeah, that's what we honor. That's our goal, God's kingdom, one of our goals. So we pray for God's kingdom to come. That ought to be a constant refrain in our prayers as we look at what's going on in the world around us. Third point that he mentions here, your will be done. We should ask that God's will is done here on earth. And two areas in particular in our personal lives, that we be humble people that God can use, tools in his hands, and also within his church, that his will be done. And of course, for his will to be done in our lives, we have to be submissive to that will. We have to allow ourselves to be used by him. Fourth point that Jesus mentions, give us this day our daily bread. So we request our daily needs to be met, which would be sustenance, the physical food we need, good health, God's protection, which we need, and the spiritual food, the spiritual bread that we need. Incidentally, there's a remez in there, give us this day our daily bread. When in Israelite history did God give daily bread? The Exodus period, where God gave them their daily bread for 40 years. There, this is an unstated remez there. But you say our daily bread, people would have immediately thought of Israel in the wilderness. And that's there's a powerful story in that. They're in the wilderness. They don't have anything to eat. They have to get bread, God giving it to them divinely to sustain them for 40 years. And where do they get water? Sometimes God has to give them water out of a rock there so they don't die of thirst. This helps us acknowledge where our source of sustenance is. It comes from God. A few other, three other points here as we conclude. Yeah, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. This also gets into this discussion we just had, not retaliating, not getting back at people, but being peacemakers. So we ask for God's help in having right relationships that are based on love and humility and forgiveness and service. And then he says, do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Some translations just say evil, but it's actually in the Greek referring to a specific evil, evil personified, which is Satan the devil. So we ask for God's help in facing and overcoming the temptations and to restrain Satan's influence in our lives. And then we end with, for yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. So we end again by focusing our prayer on God, on glorifying him because of who and what he is and what he's doing in our lives and in the church. He is all powerful. He's all knowing and all loving. He is the one who can bring this to pass. And I might mention too, it's... What is the word that is used throughout this? Give us this day. Forgive us our trespasses. It is collective. It is not, God, give me everything I want. Our prayers, by Jesus' own wording here, are outwardly focused. They're not just focused on us and our needs and our wants, but us. Our prayer should be focused outward to other people. And this is actually a very good breaking point. It's also interesting here that right after this, he again emphasizes the importance of forgiving others. So if we want to be forgiven, we have to forgive others. Ties right in with this theme we've been talking about, of being peacemakers. and having the right kind of relationships with other people.